historian Will Durant was once asked in half an hour. He did it in less than a minute this way. Civilization is a stream with banks. The stream is sometimes filled with blood from people killing, stealing, shouting, and doing the things historians usually record. While on the banks, unnoticed, people build homes, make love, raise children, sing songs, write poetry, and even whittle statues. The story of civilization is the story of what happened on the banks. Historians are pessimists because they ignore the banks for the river. Another writer dealt with this contrast much more briefly by saying, "Every morning I awakened and I am torn between my desire to savor the world and my desire to save it. This makes it hard to plan the day." And we have the same contrast in religion. The American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who was my teacher's teacher, once wrote that the abiding task of religion is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And so caught between the desire to find clarity and the desire to find comfort, we gather again to do our work together. That is why we can say that it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. A little over a century and a half ago, the Danish existentialist Søren Kierkegaard, who's probably the most influential single thinker I've had on my own thinking about religion, Kierkegaard wrote of the difference between what I might call our public lives and our private or religious lives. Our public lives are centered around what we do for a living, what causes we support, what issues or people are precious to us. They're concerned with how we spend our days. These things make up almost all of what other people know about us. And yet, he said, they're secondary. They're not the most important things about us. They serve something deeper of which we're usually not even aware. They serve what I would call our religious or spiritual selves. The way you find these deeper things, he said, the way you find what's really sacred to you is really not very hard. First, you make a mental list of the sacrifices you're making in your life, the causes you're serving, the people you are giving your time and your spirit to. And then when you have this list, you say this sentence and you complete it in your own way. The sentence is, I do all of these things in order that. All the sacrifices I make, all the things I serve with my life, I am doing them in order that. And finish it. The first concerns, you might say, are a measure of your mind, your public life, what history would record. The second concerns, the in order that dimension, live in the realm that I would call your soul. And it's the second region, the region of our in order that's, that religion is about. A religion is where we try to make our first list fit our second. Where we look at the second, where we examine our in order that's to see if what we are serving with our lives is worth serving, and if it's giving back to us the quality of life that we need. I invite you this morning and this week to call forth some of the in order that's of your own life. We're all living in order that something will be served, whether we're aware of it or not. What is that something? What are we living to serve with our lives? And is it worth our life? It's hard to think about the subject of propaganda without having to go back and read some of the Nazi propagandists. I never read them before. It was very disturbing to read them. I think it's always disturbing to read evil genius. And their understanding of propaganda, even in the 1920s, was, I think, far more profound and far more deep than we understand it today. Today we use the word just to mean sort of a cheap, superficial manipulation of feelings. They saw it as the means by which a people are brought to a new worldview. Joseph Goebbels, their minister of propaganda, said that all who preach are propagandists. All who try to convert and persuade are propagandists. And he listed on his list of some of the great propagandists of history, Christ, Muhammad, Zarathustra, and the Buddha. I don't like accepting much from Goebbels, but I accept his understanding of propaganda, and I accept the discomfort that comes with it. Another sobering insight came from another Nazi chief, Hermann Göring, speaking of how easy it is to get a people to go to war. Whether it is a democracy, a dictatorship, or a parliament, he wrote, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and to denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. It's unnerving to read Nazi propaganda geniuses today, because we also live in an age of propaganda. Although today, in our avoidance of multisyllabic words, we call it spin. We live in a time when the handlers of major politicians or corporations control the spin on their stories through very skillful manipulation of us, and often through manipulation of society's major and most powerful symbols. Right now, in our latest war craze, we're watching spin doctors manipulate the flag and the term God. We underestimate how well we are controlled by the propaganda of our age, I think. We do know it. We talk about spin in many ways. But I don't know that we realize how profoundly it has diluted our notions of truth or of moral or ethical responsibility. Abraham Lincoln once wrote famously that you can fool some of the people all the time and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time. We live in an age where his slogan has been changed somewhat. Today it goes, you can fool all the people some of the time, and you can fool some of the people all the time, and that's enough. You can rule a large country if you can do that. Now, we can challenge the government's spin, and we do. One of the things that's kept America great is the freedom to do that. The fact that we can and do speak up and speak out against the government in every area, in every way, even when we're wrong. And we have the right to do that. The day Americans become obedient and unquestioning citizens, as our new Patriot Act is demanding, is the day America dies. Last week, I indulged in some of this, wondering aloud how many schemes that work against us are being worked under the cover of war. I ranged from the probable to the paranoid. I do think, whether you agree with this or not, I do think that bombing Afghanistan was about oil, not terrorism. And I think that the word terrorism has been packaged by our spin doctors to take the place and serve the same function as the older word communism was used to do, as the abstract reason for staying in a perpetual state of war, taking hundreds of billions of dollars away from healthcare, education, social services, and empowerment of Americans, and dumping it into defense, where a huge proportion of it will wind up in the corporations who are represented in President Bush's administration, an administration with more corporate representatives than any in our history. I also went into the paranoid last week by repeating allegations that I found in one story that people in our government had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks and did nothing to stop them. That story has been circulating since last September. I now think it seems terribly unlikely that it can be true in its starkest sense. Time will tell whether there is anything solid to it and how much there is. But even in my most paranoid, I find now that I can't really believe it. It's just too incredible. However, that's the only concession I'm going to grant you from last week. It's clearly true that the Bush administration acted amazingly quickly to turn the September 11th attacks into another convenient crisis. A crisis that's convenient because it can be used and is being used skillfully to cover unrelated bills and programs that are continuing to restructure our economy and threaten our civil liberties while our public treasure is being looted. Drilling for oil in Alaska is the easiest to pick on. But it would be too easy to go off on another rant on this, and that's what I don't want to do this morning. I want to look at something more troubling instead, something that implicates all of us and makes us all complicit in things that I don't think we can be comfortable with. I want to suggest that the government couldn't do this if we hadn't already moved to a place far from anything resembling a democracy, if we hadn't already moved to accepting rule by the few instead of by the many. We've long been aware that the few who contribute the most money to major political campaigns pull far more strings in determining the nature and direction of the government than we do. We know that politicians are beholden to them. That's how business works. We say it openly, often, and everywhere. These are people with the power to vote themselves large amounts of money from the public treasury. I remember the quote that I gave you last week from the 18th century historian who thought democracy was not a form of government that could last long, that it would end as soon as a group of people realized that they could find ways to vote themselves money from the public treasury, and democracy would then end to be followed by a dictatorship. I don't think we're heading to a dictatorship, though I do think we have already come to the point of being ruled by the few rather than the wishes and best interests of the many. What worries me is that no two dictatorships or aristocracies are quite alike. They're all made up of different combinations of parts, and I think the parts we'll use in our American aristocracy are quite different from the parts that were used in some others. And some of the parts, even if you like bits of it, you can't like all of it. Here's the last quote I'll take from the Nazi propagandists, and they were very upsetting to read. I do not like reading evil geniuses. This is from Hitler's Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels. It's the only paragraph I found in the 50 or 60 pages of his essays that I read that talks about the economy. I do not see the economy as some sort of way of making money. Rather, I want an economy that will strengthen the people, make them healthy and powerful. Socialism has a very different sense of economy than capitalism does. Nobody would describe our economy this way. We're very clear and even very proud of the fact that our economy is about making money. One author has described us as a winner-take-all society, in the title of a book of his that I read. I like that. A winner-take-all society is a kind of capitalist aristocracy, a rule by the few individuals and corporations who have the most money and power, and therefore deserve whatever they can get. A winner-take-all society. I remember in my own life when it was not this way. A little more than 40 years ago, the wealthiest Americans paid up to 90% in income taxes. Corporations paid a far greater share of the taxes than they now do. The GI Bill after World War II enabled and empowered millions and millions of regular lower and middle class Americans to get good college educations and find good, well-paying and secure jobs. Also after World War II, the Levittown houses and then similar housing developments all over the country made it possible for regular working people all over America to own their own homes. Good homes. Middle class homes. You can still see them around Austin and other cities. Now tax rates on the wealthiest have fallen below 40%. And now workers building new apartment buildings in Austin cannot afford to live in any of the apartments that they are building. It's change, and I remember when it was different. It is a winner-take-all society, and it didn't used to be. I don't think we want to realize how completely we've accepted this. We may think foreign sweatshops are terrible, foreign sweatshops where young children work 12-hour days for less than a buck an hour, making almost all of our expensive tennis shoes, many of our clothes, many other items. We do think it's terrible until we go shopping, and then we buy them. And so we endorse and support the sweatshops that we like to believe we think are a terrible thing. Our actions shout so loud, our words are drowned out. We know that shipping thousands of jobs to Mexico or China has meant that thousands of Americans cannot make a decent living in this country. But when we go to Walmart or Target, we look for the lowest prices, and we conspire with ourselves to forget that the reason the prices are the lowest is because the workers were barely paid at all. We like a winner-take-all society when we think we're winning and taking. I have read that with only 5% of the world's population, we consume 25% of the world's energy. And I think, yeah, that's bad. That's a bad thing. But I am not willing to do without air conditioning. And I want gas for my car. I'm not willing to give up the benefits we've been able to take because we've had the power to take them. A few years ago, I was preaching in a Unitarian church far from here when I heard what is still my favorite ironic example of this kind of tunnel vision of ours. During the announcements, a young woman made a very passionate and very angry announcement about the damage being done to Mother Earth through the destruction of the Brazilian rainforests. I remember this clearly. And how hateful and awful this was, and how decent people everywhere have to oppose it. And she announced that this church had a social action group that was meeting to oppose the destruction to the Brazilian rainforest, and invited anyone in the church who was interested to join them for their meeting after church, which would be held in the local Burger King. The reason Burger King has cheap meat is because they graze their cattle in what used to be Brazilian rainforests. We are complicit up to our necks. We don't know it, and we don't want to know it. We are much more comfortable in an aristocracy than we want to pretend. We like living in a winner-take-all society, as long as we think we're winning. I've whined before here, and I will whine again, about the loss of our humanities education in America. As the marketplace gets more competitive, students now have to take many more practical courses. And so they have less time for niceties like humanities. They learn what they can do and how to do it, and how to do it well and competitively, and that is defined as an education. It didn't used to be. An education used to be about how to become most fully and proudly human. That's what the humanities were about. That's what religion is about. They used to teach us how to ask whether what we were planning to do was noble, whether people of the highest character could be proud of it. And we learned that if they couldn't, neither should we be. That's what an education was about. It's learning how to earn a good living as full humans. We've lost something there. That's where religion and society need to be mixed well and served up together. However, and this is another worry, I think, what's passing for religion is becoming more frightening than comforting. And I think that this new kind of religion is going to be a part of the new kind of world order that gets established in America. I want to worry you about this. A colleague sent me a new book about this force that's trying to take over conservative Christianity, but also Christianity. The book is called The Clash of Orthodoxies, Law, Religion, and Morality in Crisis. It's by Robert George, who's a Princeton University law professor. The new orthodoxy is characterized by a litany of conservative social issues, but no religious ones. The social issues have taken the place of religious beliefs. The list includes, and everyone here can figure out what is going to be on this list. The list includes concerns about abortion, homosexuality, marriage, euthanasia, and the requirement for mandatory expressions of religious faith in public, whether through prayer in schools or prayer at football games. This new orthodoxy, says the study, is gradually taking the place of traditional Christian beliefs and being identified in their minds as what Christianity is about. This would have been big news to Jesus. Those who are doing it might call that mixing religion and society together. It's not religion. It's political ideology. It has a lot to do with fascist agendas and with most of the same concerns that fascist governments have had. It's what I talked about 2 months ago as the biological default setting that we share with thousands of territorial species. The strongly male-dominated hierarchical structure of society that cares about normative kinds of sexuality, men on top, obedience, law and order, and so on and so forth. I want to go back, though, to this winner-take-all society. That's something that we've accepted without worrying too much about. But I want us to look at what that means and what that society is and who we have become. And I want us to ask how proud we can be of it. Throughout history, this ethical style has been described in other ways than a winner-take-all society. Mostly it's been called the ethics of might makes right. The perversion of the golden rule that says he who has the gold makes the rules. When we teach ethics in any ethics course I've ever known, this is always presented as a moral abomination, not a noble path. I don't know of any society teaching might makes right that is ever held up as something to admire. People of good character don't act this way. And this business of making the upper class the favored class, of having rule by a few, the few people and corporations with the most power and the most money, that is not democracy and it cannot be democracy. It is the definition of aristocracy. It's already moved from a democracy, and so have we, and we don't see it. And we should see it. Because in democracy, there is a most important class, but it's the middle class. After World War II, it was the middle class that was being empowered and enriched by very different tax laws and GI Bill. The middle class that was enabled to buy decent homes with their wages. Why is the middle class the linchpin of democracy? Because at the top, there will always be, in any society, exceptional people who will excel in any system. They're brighter or more focused, more gifted, harder working. They will rise to the top always. They don't need help to get there. There are superior people, and they'll always rise to the top. And at the bottom, there will always be people, for a variety of reasons, who cannot or will not compete. They need to be protected from starvation and disease and treated with dignity, but they are miles away from the top tier and everybody knows it. There's only one thing that can let people at the bottom believe there is any realistic hope of rising, and that is a powerful, wealthy, and empowered middle class. Those are the rungs on the ladder of the American dream, and without them, the American dream does not exist. But even more importantly than the middle class, the idea of a winner-take-all society where we are ruled by the wishes of a few has done things to us of which we choose not to be aware, and of which I don't think we can be proud. And a decent religious mixture with society, I mean the healthy concerns of religion, could have educated us and needed to. For instance, this word terrorism is being forced down our throats as though we really thought it was a bad thing. We don't think it's a bad thing. We've been doing it for decades. Do you know that we are the only country that has ever been condemned by the World Court for perpetrating international terrorism? By one count, since the end of World War II, the United States has helped overthrow or attempted to overthrow more than 40 foreign governments and to crush more than 30 populist or nationalist movements struggling against intolerable regimes. That's us. And that's terrorism, and we love it, and we do it. And it helps us win, and winners take all. So we have cheap oil prices, we have cheap clothing prices. In the course of this, we've caused the deaths of millions of people in foreign lands that most of us can't even find on the map. I can't find them either on a map. This is winner take all. This is living by the ethical rule that might makes right. It's an ethic identified as a moral crime by every religion in the world. People of good character cannot act like that. When I begin mixing religion with society, that's how I want to mix them. I think we need the insights and the critiques of honest and healthy religion more than we ever have. I don't mean the kind of mass propaganda we will be subjected to on May 2nd, our National Prayer Day, where our two most powerful national symbols, the flag and the word God, will be co-opted to serve an aggressive war in countries with access to the oil that we have wanted for decades. I don't mean the kind of a puppet God who can be ordered to bless America, but not allowed to challenge or chastise America. I mean real religion. Jesus said, "Whatever you do to the least of these, you do also to me." If our American Christians really believed that, they would not abide living in the only country ever condemned by the World Court for International Terrorism. Jews have long taught that considering themselves to be God's chosen people never meant they got more favors from God. It has always and only meant that God held them to a higher moral and ethical standard than others and would punish them if they failed. That's what's written in the Old Testament. If they believed it, they would condone neither the actions of our country nor the actions of Israel. Hindus and Buddhists all teach that our actions against others have consequences, that what goes around comes around, that behaving as greedy bullies will create a bad karma that we may spend several lifetimes undoing. The greatest nation on earth should settle for nothing less than being the greatest moral leaders on earth by operating cooperatively rather than dictatorially. And the purpose of acting up as Americans should be to help restore the nation to its moral and ethical greatness, not just a long-standing habit of greed paired with murderous force. That's part of what happens when you mix religion and society together. Well, this is my point. That's the cost and the purpose and the reason for mixing religion and society. I don't need to go on with this point and turn it into a rant. You all understand it. Whenever we criticize our country, and this is what I was trying to remind myself of with the Will Durant reading I used in the opening, it's easy to forget that while many things are wrong with it, many more things are right with it. There has not been a political coup. We have not lost America. While our media are not vigorous or brave, they're still investigating criminality and cover-ups, even if only because they make sensational news stories. The court system still mostly works all the way to the top. The Supreme Court's 6-3 decision 2 weeks ago stating that virtual child pornography on the internet is protected by the First Amendment, no matter what you think of the decision, shows that the Supreme Court is not, by any token, in the pocket of the far right. Governmental agencies at every level still employ tens of thousands of people with conscience, a strong sense of right and wrong, and the desire and the courage to try to make government accountable to higher principles. The social programs of conservative, no matter how fascist they sound, almost never can win a majority of conservatives, because conservatives know better and vote them down at the polls. Liberals may not be many, but we continue to be the yeast that makes America rise toward its higher callings. And that's good news. And all over the country, we're still surrounded by millions of people we can and do trust with our lives every day. The ancient Romans had a saying, that's always been sacred for me and which I offer to you now. They said that noble people should live as though they were under the gaze of all the other noble people who had ever lived. They said we should live as though every action we think of taking were being watched by all of the people in history we would most respect. And then, under that gaze of eternity, as they called it, we should reconsider what we're about to do and do only that of which we and all those imagined eyes watching us could be most proud. Not what we can get away with, not what our military or economic might lets us inflict on all who are weaker, not what winners can pull off, only those acts of which we can be most proud. If I have a prayer for America right now, I pray that we all try to live in such a way that when we and those we love look back on it, we will be able to be proud. Just that. Just that.